Welcome to Season 3, Episode 12 of Swift Over Coffee. I'm Paul Hudson.
And I'm Michaela Karen.
And in this episode, we discuss the pros and cons of pair programming.
So you're passing on that knowledge of fire, right? It helps them learn, helps you learn as well, because you're teaching effectively.
We share what you do to make your apps more accessible. His mother-in-law has lots of great advice about localization, copyright, vision, and mobility issues. So, Michael, I'm hoping that means, can we all send test flights to your mother-in-law? Is that allowed?
Plus. Okay, so listen, folks. It's been like a month or so since the last recording. Michaela and I have both been very, very busy. I've been busy working. Michaela, what have you been busy doing?
I've been busy doing nothing, even though, you know, I have a deadline impending. I have been, deadlines mean nothing. Time is a construct. I went to a wedding. I've been to Florida. I've been snowboarding and just, you know, taking a slight break, even though I have a deadline like looming over me now.
And you're currently in California. And after this, you're going somewhere else.
Yeah. After this, I'm going to be going up to Whistler, Canada to go snowboarding some more because I've gone less this year than I did last year, which is kind of wild.
But
yeah, right now, I know I haven't gone snowboarding enough. I need more. Right now I'm actually in California because I recently went to the Vision Pro Dev Camp. Which is like a weekend long hackathon for the Vision Pro. So I believe we set the record, I think, for the most number of Vision Pros in a single place, you know?
as records go, that's one of the fairly easy ones to beat at this point, right?
But we still set it.
Yeah. I am wondering whether there'll be some sort of Vision Pro stuff actually at Apple Park special event this year because, I mean, more on this later on, but Dublin has been announced, folks. And I'm thinking maybe there was some sort of Vision Pro meetup there, maybe at Apple Park on the day, or folks at home see it in 3D. That'll be exciting. Who knows?
Ooh, so many things. We hope so. Yeah, I've been doing the Vision Pro Dev Camp, but then also I have a talk that I'm going to be giving on the Vision Pro for the Women Who Code Mobile. So it's going to be a beginner's guide to the Apple Vision Pro. So it's going to start with the complete basics. What is the Vision Pro? What's Vision OS? And we will see. I'm hoping to be able to do a live demo. It's remote. So that does that mean if more things will go wrong or less things can go wrong than in person?
Look, either way, it's really if the demo gods smile on you that day, that's all you know what happens. It's random. But I would say, folks, if you're interested in that, Women Who Code sounds like you could only sign up if you're a woman, but actually they invite everyone to sign up and get involved. If you'd like to go along, male, female, whatever you want to, please sign up and go along and hear Michaela speak. So while Michaela's been having fun, it's doing things, which is great. Where in the world is Michaela Karen these days? Who knows? I've been doing actual work. I went to Tokyo for a week to speak at TriSwift Tokyo. And it was really intense, partly because of the 9-hour time difference at the time, which is just brutal. Partly because my kids are saying, listen, you've got to go here and here and here and buy this and this and this to bring home for them. But partly also because my talk was about building websites with Swift, and the talk went very well. It was live, translated in both English and Japanese, which is great. I'd, you know, speak pause. So I could translate live as I'm speaking, which is great. But at the end, I launched my new project, and I mentioned it here briefly a few episodes ago. It's now actually a real thing shipping to the world. It's called Ignite, and it's a static site website builder for Swift. So you can create beautiful, accessible, responsive websites in Swift with hardly any code. It's quite beautiful. So check that one out.
Ooh, that's so exciting. Ignite, does it also do like, you know, light and dark mode on the website, like with CSS?
It ought to. It did before the week beforehand. I took it out. I wasn't happy with it. So I've got to go back to that and basically look at it again because it needs to do light and dark mode for CSS. I want to do light and dark mode for pictures automatically as well. So you can have light, dark mode pictures just flip over nicely, like 2x pictures, 1x pictures just happening automatically. But right now it focuses on responsive. So it adapts your site correctly from mobile to desktop flawlessly, which is really, really nice.
Yeah, that's super nice.
And folks have shipped sites with it already, which is amazing. There are two sites already running with Ignite, which is great. People are very, very keen to try it out. So I'm getting back into it and doing more with it.
I'll have to definitely look at that because we have been looking at updating the iOS Dev Happy Hour site and thinking about that. So Ignite may be the option. Sounds like it.
The reason I made it was because I recognized a lot of folks are Swift experts And a lot of folks are HTML / CSS experts, but not many folks are good at both.
Yeah.
Or have time to be good at both. Because just doing iOS and Swift and whatever is a lot of work by itself. And so you got to learn things about, you know, media queries and CSS. And like, most folks don't care. We want to write great Swift code. And so Ignite takes care of that for you, which is the beautiful thing about it.
Yes, that's super nice. Because I am on the camp of, my web dev is not my favorite, but it's, I know some basics. But that's where it ends.
I reckon Ignite's for you. That's our third site built in Swift. There you go.
Here we go. Yep. I will find it in all my time and deadlines to do that. We have some exciting news this time.
Yes.
WWDC has finally been announced.
Yes.
So for anybody who's listening in the present, it will work. If you're in the past, it's already happened and you'll know things we don't know. But June 10th to 14th will be WWDC 24.
Will you be there, Michaela? Because I certainly will be.
Yes, I will be there whether or not I have a golden ticket. So yep. For anyone who doesn't know today, even though it will be in the past at this point, today on April 3rd is the last day to apply to get into WWDC. They have like a raffle system. So you get your name picked out of a hat and then you are able to go to WWDC for free, as in the ticket is free, but you have to figure out how to travel and fly yourself there.
Are you in the raffle at least?
Yes, I did make it.
Yeah, me too. I'm in there too. Again, I put my flights already. I put my hotel already. I'm going to be there for 12 days this year.
Oh, wow.
I was there for 11 last year from like Wednesday beforehand through to Sunday. And it wasn't quite enough. I ended up being tired on Monday morning because jet lag is 8 hours for me, mm-hmm. right? It's a lot. So I'm now flying out Tuesday, an extra day to try and get another day of jet lag beating. And I hope it works because it's a really busy week. And in fact, today, maybe tomorrow, but obviously, by the time this goes out, it'll be last week probably, I'll be releasing a video on my experience last year at WWDC. You were in the video, Michaela. You
ooh,
started the
yes.
video briefly. I shot a lot of video. Yeah, I shot a lot of video last year of just talking to folks, speaking about folks and asking them WWDC tips and why to go and what to do. And that's coming out hopefully real soon on my YouTube channel. So I'm looking forward to that. I had to learn Final Cut Pro to do that for the very first time. That was a lot of work.
Ooh, yes, video editing is not my forte.
No.
A secret, if anyone didn't know, totally off topic, is none of the videos on my YouTube channel, I've never edited any of those. I've outsourced all the editing.
Oh, there you go.
Because I don't edit videos.
I've got a hack, which is I just don't edit most of the time, if possible. I do it all in one take.
That is why I live stream.
Otherwise, there you go. Exactly, yeah. But so what Michaela hasn't said yet, and this is worth saying, there are many, many alternative events. So, you know, it's not just go out there if you haven't got a ticket. You can go out there without a ticket. And there are multiple alternative events you can go to, including everyone's favorite, Michaela. What happens normally on, I don't know, Tuesday evening, maybe?
Yes, we will have iOS Dev Happy Hour IRL. We're thinking Tuesday. It's most likely going to be it, but we haven't technically finalized it yet. But yes, we have an event where we are just like, hanging out, just come chat with a bunch of people because we have our monthly iOS Dev Happy Hour meetup that's on Zoom. But around WWDC time is the one time we have an in real life event and actually get together and get to see, you know, how tall everybody is. And then me figuring out that Alex, Alan, Frank, Blake, Chris, everybody is taller than me.
Oh, your event, sells out extremely quickly. So you want to see it announced, grab your ticket quickly, folks. Don't if you'll be in town. Grab the happy hour ticket. It's a second, it's like a silver ticket, as it were. It's not a golden ticket. It's really good. So it's hard to get. Get that one. But there are stacks of others. And in fact, there are whispers. And by the time this goes out, hopefully formal announcements of actual parallel events to WWDC this year. And if that's true, that'll be very, very exciting indeed. So watch out for that. Very, very cool.
Yep. So think of basically following all of the different social media. So like iOS Dev Happy Hour, we announce hours on our socials and then also in our Discord. So like we'll announce the event. Tickets are free for hours. So like you just have to be one of the first ones to sign up, hopefully, because time zones are hard, but try to sign up as quick as you can. Because yes, our like sells out just of like we have capacity limits on the number of people that can be in one spot at one time. But then all the other parallel events, I'm sure we'll also go through and announce like the different events that are happening because we're all, as all organizers, I think throughout all of like the iOS dev community, many of us know each other and we're trying to all coordinate so that we don't overlap with too many events.
Yeah, so there'll be the hopefully Revenue Cap Barcade that was last year on Sunday evening. There was James Dempsey in the Breakpoints. That's always very good. I think it was Wednesday last
that sounds right.
year or Thursday last year.
It all blurred together.
Yeah, there's They do, because it's a busy week, right? Lots of things happening. Mm-hmm. Plus, of course, you're meeting friends and hanging out, and there'll be a watch party. Michi Yang running a brilliant in-person space last year. Folks come and watch the keynote together and, you know, clap and cheer and whoop and so forth. It's honestly so much fun. If you don't get a ticket, fine. Please still consider going, because it's just a great place to be. Our theme this episode is pair programming. Why should you do it? What are the pros and cons along the way? And hopefully, if you haven't tried it before, give you at least some encouragement to give it a try, because I'm a big believer in pair programming. Are you a fan of it, Michaela?
Yeah, I like pair programming overall.
Oh, okay. That's carefully phrased, you know?
We are on a podcast.
That's true. Look, there is no silver bullet, as Fred Brooks wrote years ago in his book, The Mythical Man Month. There is no magical one way to fix every coding problem. And pair programming is a big thing. It's a useful thing to have, but don't think it's perfect. There are downsides to it too. Firstly, why do it? What are the reasons to do it? I think the biggest one for me personally is when I am forced to work with somebody else and say things out loud, what I'm thinking and why, I automatically find myself thinking carefully about how I phrase things, form my words carefully, try to think along the way, what could it be this, what about this, da, da, da. And so I'm basically teaching the other person what I think is the right approach. And they might know all the code already, but at least I'm teaching my approach. And it forced me, therefore, to make sure I understand my concept really, really clearly, that I'm not sort of guessing my way through or saying, I'll burn that bridge later or whatever. I will tackle up front now and explain it in sensible words. And what's that quote? Like, if you can't explain it in simple words, you don't really understand it. That's kind of what it is. If I can't explain it clearly, I shouldn't be coding it in the first place. That's, I think, for me, the biggest advantage.
Yeah, I think what really helps with that, too, is that you have to explain something, or you can explain something in the technical terms of how you're doing something. So you can be like, okay, we are going to use nil coalescing to setting this variable. And if somebody who's also brand new, they don't know what that term is, but maybe they've seen it in code, they then now know that new term, and then they can get better at Googling things of being like, okay, what does this actually mean? And then that can help them Google the right things to figure out something later on too.
Yeah, so you're passing on like the knowledge of fire, right? It helps them learn, helps you learn as well, because you're teaching effectively, and hopefully they bounce back their ideas, you learn from them as well. It's a discussion. It's genuinely pairing. You work as a team the entire time, and it works so well. It's a small team, tightly knit team, as opposed to like a 12-person team where some folks can kind of disappear into the background very easily. In a good pairing, that should be possible, right?
Mm-hmm. And I really like how pair programming also helps you get unstuck with different problems.
Yeah.
Because you'll reach out to like your senior dev being like, hey, I've tried this, this, and this. I can't figure this out. Okay, let's start pair programming. You pair on this. And sometimes though, the magic of watching a senior developer just do something that you just have not thought of after looking at it for like an hour is wild. You're just like, it didn't even occur to me that this could be something that you could do. And just seeing that happen is just like, oh my gosh, that's just wild.
Yeah, and it's interesting. When you go to a dub lab, and this is back in the days when it was in person, they would say things like, okay, I can see the problem here. Let's solve it now. And they'd talk you through, I don't know, Core Audio or UIKit, whatever it was at the time. And they would tell you the code to write to solve your problem. They would never, ever, ever touch your laptop. Maybe it's for legal reasons. I'm not sure what the reasoning was actually, but it felt like they were making you think it through and apply the code yourself. And as a result, you have to actually think about it and work it through and make mistakes and be corrected and da da da. And so you're learning as you're going. And so it's a very effective way of helping someone learn along the way. Ron is to be told, that's your answer, mm-hmm. Which is, as you say, impressive, but is it effective in teaching? I'm not sure.
I think it goes back to too, like our debugging episode that we chatted about the different ways that you can debug. When you pair program with somebody, you can see them do something or challenge something that you assumed to not be true, or like you assumed that you couldn't do something, but then seeing somebody in pair programming suddenly do that thing, it just unlocks like a whole different world, because you're like, you didn't even think that that was possible. So you didn't consider that as a solution or a path to get to a solution. But then somebody, when pair programming, all of a sudden does that thing. You're like, wait, what? Like, what just happened here?
Mind blown, right?
Literally.
So there are some weaknesses, though. At least weaknesses how I perceive them. And this is more about pairing being done, I think, poorly when people aren't really bought into the idea of pairing. And one of them is when you have a team of people, two people, and they don't switch who's doing typing, who's doing what we call driving or piloting. If one person does all the typing, or that person provides, you know, over the shoulder, like rear seat driving kind of thing, right? Do this, do that. You can get code done that way. Of course you can. But I found again and again and again, if you aren't the one typing, the drive to actually learn what's happening is lower. If you are forced to actually make things happen with your fingers, you must really understand what's actually happening, what code must be put into here, method calls, variables, whatever, is much stronger because you have to type it yourself. And so really get a good changeover, whether it's story points or time-based or who knows what, changing regularly matters. So a disadvantage, if someone isn't doing that, that's a big, I think, pairing problem.
Yeah, I completely agree. Because, like, you know how nervous we all get with pair programming and freaking out about being the one typing? And you're like, oh, I can't type today.
I got fingers like, don't
yes,
work.
That happens. But then also, if you then are the person typing, no matter how much you mess up or put a, you know, parenthesis when there is a curly brace or whatever, you will understand it then because you're the person physically then typing it out. So like, even if you type it wrong, like three times, you're like, I can't type today. But then when you finally do get the right thing, you then will remember it possibly more because you're then the person typing. So definitely being able to, like you said, change off who is typing, whether it's time-based or story points or whatever, that is super useful.
I read some research recently about why schools that require students to handwrite during class tend to outperform schools that require students to type during class. And we think, you know, digital literacy, you'll learn more effectively with computers. What they found is literally the act of being forced to draw these shapes with your hand as you write letters out engages more of your brain than pressing the A key, the S key, whatever it is. And so by engaging more parts of your brain, by being forced to write shapes of writing, you learn more effectively. And obviously, I'm not saying handwrite your code, but going from saying the words to thinking the words and typing the words out, again, it's a leap up in difficulty. It helps you learn it much more effectively, I think.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I know that happens for me too. Like, I have to write things down. Generally, now I do my iPad and write stuff like in notes and Notability or something. But that definitely helps me for sure, because I type all day. I could just type a to-do. It will disappear into an abyss. So it has to be written for me.
Into the vortex of other to-dos somewhere else on your desktop, you know, to-do three, to-do final, to-do I mean it this time. Yeah, it's bad. It's bad.
Yes.
So what do you think about times when we have, again, a pair that isn't working very functionally very well, but this time because maybe they're not fully on the same page. Maybe someone thinks, I'm a super amazing rock star developer and this junior developer's paired with me. I can't show off my great skills. How do you think that happens and how it has to be resolved nicely?
I think one thing is being on the same page with the other developer, understanding you're both trying to accomplish the same thing, for one, is we're both trying to get whatever task done. But then secondly, it's being on the same page and communication level where you're like, okay, one may be better than the other, but the goal then in the end is you both understand the thing. So if only one person ends up understanding it, okay, well, if it was my ticket to begin with and I'm the junior developer, that then doesn't help me because when I go to write the PR, I'm kind of just like, we did some things. So then you have to understand what's happening. So whether that is asking questions or if it is just being like, oh, wait, okay, so we just went through, we wrote like 50 lines of code. Let's now, you could then as a junior dev be like, okay, wait, let's now go back and understand and talk through what just happened. What is this function? Like, does it need to be 50 lines? And just go back from the beginning because in the end, everybody has to maintain the code base together.
Yeah, you're on the same team. Whoever commits it, fine, but someone else has to maintain it next week, the week after, the month after, the year after, the whatever, however long the code lasts. And so being able to explain it simply matters. And if you can't explain it simply, maybe the code isn't the best it could be. Like, can the code be made simpler? Can you pull it apart, break it apart, simplify the algorithm slightly? Oh, and now the junior can understand it. Maybe that's the level we should be coding for in the first place, because code is read far more than it's written.
Mm-hmm. And then, like we said, also, I think in the debugging episode, where we first make it work and then make the code better. So like maybe the way that we made it work is a little hacky or not the best, but then like two people are looking at it. So it's kind of like we're already doing almost like not PR review exactly, but we're already two people are looking at the code right now. So the way we wrote this initially, maybe we'll commit it, but it's not the best way that we could write this in the end too. So two people are looking at our code. Okay, now once we write it, go through and actually be like, is this the best way? And that then can also help both sides understand what did we just write.
Well, it kind of is code review, isn't it? Really good pairing when it's done effectively. And Kent Beck's quote you mentioned briefly, make it work, make it right, make it fast, is true of so many things. And, you know, I've written a lot of code in the make it work phase. People go, what the hell is this? Who wrote which orangutan had a cocaine binge and wrote this code, whatever it was, you know? And it's like, I spent weeks writing that code. And that's normal, you know, but having a pair person go over it and explain it will help you write better code, I think. And that's a good thing. But I do worry that folks, particularly in our industry, we've got this sort of stereotype of being introverted, we're shy, we're loners. My first ever coding job in an office in London, people used to walk in, sit down, and then turn the lights out in the office. So everyone working in the dark in the office and have little lamps next to them because it was just cool and elite. I don't know what it is. But anyway, that's what, you know, we work in isolation because that's who we are. We're coders. And I don't know, it's not true for a start. A lot of coders don't work like that, that's for sure. But I can see folks who are shy thinking, well, I'm not sure I can handle pairing. I have people looking over my shoulder the entire time while I'm trying to code. That sounds horrible.
Yeah, and I think because of that, one of the easiest ways then to get started with pair programming is to start with rubber duck.
Yeah.
Rubber duck programming or rubber duck debugging. Mm. So for anyone who hasn't heard this term, it's, which I do have one, you get like a rubber duck and you set it on your desk. And you kind of just talk to this rubber duck, like talk through your code and talk through your code process. So if you don't have a rubber duck, you can then talk to your mouse, talk to your keyboard, talk to just something, talking out loud, because it's like when you're reading and writing, sometimes you could write something, but then when you go and read it back out loud, it kind of doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
The same thing happens with programming.
Yeah. Talk to your dog if you want to, whatever helps, you know. Interestingly enough, I went to Amsterdam last year and I'm not sure why there were quite a few stores just selling rubber ducks. And it would be like a Batman rubber duck, an Iron rubber duck, a Doctor Who rubber duck, every kind of duck imaginable. So if you want to get a great duck, maybe go to Amsterdam and get your ducks. It does matter. Saying out loud matters. In fact, I got a great tip from Dave Verwer, who does iOS Dev Weekly, brilliant newsletter in our community. He said sometimes he makes the Mac, he selects the text of the newsletter and says, you know, speak the text. And it reads it back to him, the text. Because you can look at it and not see the typos and not hear the double words, whatever it is, by accident you missed out. But having it spoken back to you makes a big difference. So it does matter.
That can help with variable naming.
Last but not least, I want to mention one thing, which is that I very frequently ask people to do pairing when I teach workshops. Because this is when people are learning something new, like Swift Data or Observable, whatever it is. And it's a really horrible feeling when you're learning something new and you've got to apply that thing. You're like, well, I didn't understand it. And there's like 30 folks in this group and I bet they all got it first time. I'm clearly very stupid. I'm back in the class. Whereas if there's someone pairing with you, you're like, well, did you get it? Nope. Did you get it? Nope. Cool. And you feel much better. Knowing that you aren't alone and not understanding something makes you feel much, much better. And it can be a big confidence booster for many, many people.
Our open ballot this episode is, what do you do to make your apps more accessible? And we actually got a couple answers, I would say. A lot of very good quality answers, but there were very few. So I think that means maybe some of us are not making our apps accessible. And if that's you, then listen to these responses and pick one and start working on it. The first one, Brevin Blalock says that he hasn't had enough focus on this. So the next update, this will be the subject of his. So again, here's all the responses everybody had. So you can pick one and work on it. And then also for everybody else, remember, accessibility is a very wide topic. We're not just talking about voiceover. So because of that, there's so many different ways to improve. So just pick one and start. You don't have to do everything from the beginning.
Except for you now, Brevin, we're going to hold you accountable. I want to hear from you in like 2 weeks, 3 weeks, 4 weeks, whatever it is, the next update. Tweet at Michaela and me saying it's done now, what you changed and why. We'd love to know, but we're expecting to hear back from you, Brevin. Don't let us down.
And if you don't tweet at us, we can tweet at you. Okay, first up, we have Claudia, who mentions Apple's predefined fonts have dynamic type for free. So first, dynamic type is increasing or decreasing the font size based on somebody's settings. But she also goes on to mention VoiceOver, although a bit harder to get started with, is super helpful. She no longer uses a huge amount of colors. Keep it to just black, whites, and grays, and one color for those color limitations.
So dynamic type is one of those things that folks often don't think about, but they're missing a massive trick here. If you use Apple's built-in font styles, you know, Title 2, large title, the new ones, Vision Pro, extra large title and similar, body, headline, whatever. Yes, different sizes, getting bigger and smaller, which is great. You get different weights as well. So bolder, semi-bold, black, the extra heavy ones, or the lighter fonts automatically. It just the line space automatically, the letter spacing. And so things like on Vision Pro, all the fonts get slightly bolder, so they stand out better on the glass effect background. So using these things is really, really helpful. And if that hasn't convinced you yet, one more thing is that 40% of folks who've changed their default text size have gone to a smaller text size. They want to cram in more information on their phone. And so if your app's like, no, I shall show large fonts no matter what, it makes you look kind of crummy. And so people want to have these things, not because of accessibility reasons, but also they want to just cram in more information sometimes.
Oh, that's surprising for me. I usually do the opposite, and I would make font bigger because I don't need eye strain this early. Next, Yash mentions that they still have a lot to learn about this topic, but the initial way to improve was vision-related app accessibility, which would be dynamic type sizes and using your app with VoiceOver. Even small improvements to these can make an app experience significantly better. And I agree. It's like we talked about at the beginning, pick one thing to start with and make the experience good for that one thing, because that one thing could be something that somebody uses to use your app. So no matter what you pick within accessibility, just pick one to get started.
Yeah, and VoiceOver, as both Yash and Claudia have said, it's not easy to start with, but it does matter very, very much because it's kind of the basis for how many other of these system tools see your app, how they read your app. Things like Switch Control, if it works great with VoiceOver, it'll work well, hopefully, with Switch Control out of the box, which is great. And if you want to really test yourself, if you're like, okay, I think I've got good VoiceOver experience now, I'm quite pleased with myself, what you want to do is, once you have VoiceOver turned on, is with three fingers, quickly triple tap the screen. So three fingers, three taps. And it enables what's called the screen curtain. And it means your phone is fully active, fully responsive, but the screen's completely black. You can't see anything at all. And now you're like, okay, this is how blind users actually see my app, how they feel my app working the entire time. And if you can get around your app perfectly with that, fine, you've nailed it. But it might make you realize, oh, wow, that thing there that should be hidden isn't actually hidden. I can get to that control. It's supposed to be off the screen somewhere. Whoops. So give that a try too.
Yes, that is an amazing tip, because I know as somebody who is not blind and not vision impaired in any way, it is hard for me to then imagine how somebody uses my app. So being able to use the screen curtain really helps because, yeah, it darkens the whole phone. You can't see anything. And that's great. Also, Danny Behar mentions he uses a Mac app called Sim Daltonism. It's a viewport filter that you can drag and drop on top of a simulator or web browser, or really anything on your computer, and it allows you to see the software behind a filter that simulates the most common types of colorblindness.
I'm going to try it now. It sounds great. It does sound great. I feel guilty getting this app for free. It sounds too good to be true. Install, open the app. Oh, so it records the screen and then layers over it what it would otherwise be able to see. That sounds clever, actually. I see how it's done now. Okay, fair enough. Oh, it does work. Oh, that's really clever. Oh, wow. This is very clever. Well, why doesn't Apple make this? That's genius. All right. So I've just tried the app out, Sim Daltonism. It's very, very good. Wow. It's, I mean, if Yeah, you just choose the adjustment you want to make, you know, is it Protanopia, Deuteranopia, whatever, and it just enables that thing, just drag the window around over your screen and see exactly what it looks like. Why is that not built into Xcode? That is absolutely genius. Well done to that developer. Michel Fortin, perhaps. That's very, very good. Well done. Folks, go and get that from the App Store. It's completely free and works exactly like it's predicted. Well, well done.
Man, that's awesome. We'll also link that in the show notes then so that everybody can have a link and yeah, quickly download that and just look at what does your phone look like with any kind of color blindness. Because if people don't remember sometimes, but there's multiple different kinds of color blindness too. So being able to accommodate all of them and or at least cover the most common types is definitely a pro.
Yes.
Michael Kritz mentions, invite your friends and family to test your app. His mother-in-law has lots of great advice about localization, copyright, vision, and mobility issues. So, Michael, I'm hoping that means, can we all send test flights to your mother-in-law? Is that allowed? But yeah, definitely having other people look at your app is super helpful because, you know, when you're developing it, you spend so much time just staring at the same couple screens, you may not notice something that somebody else immediately notices as the very first thing right off the bat.
Yeah. We adapt, we know what's going to do, we do it that way. And two things spring to mind about this. First, I think I mentioned this before, years ago, Novell, back when they were the thing in the 2000s, did a user study where they had users sit down and use their email client. And they filmed the user's screen, filmed their face, filmed the room, filmed the whole works, try and see what they're actually feeling and doing. And they found users were sort of pressing this button that had a picture of an email, like a envelope on the thing. And it was a send-receive button, which was a thing back then. You press a button to do a send-receive request to your email. Send now, receive now, whatever. And they saw a picture of an envelope and thought, well, I'll press that. That must mean write me a new mail. And they're pressing and nothing happened. Press, nothing happened. And it was doing send-receive in the background. And they weren't getting what they wanted. They just didn't understand what was going on. They thought it meant something different and tied to what users thought. And it's you get stuck in this thing, meaning that's obviously the send-receive button, but someone else thinking, well, that's not, that means something else to me. And it's challenging sometimes. The second thing is a brilliant talk, which I'm not sure it's online, by Dave Verwer again from iOS Dev Weekly. And he was talking about getting feedback from users. And he said, you know, when you ask users things like, have you used feature X? Have you used feature Y? How do you rate feature Z? Whatever. Often they would get contradictory answers back from users. The user says something like, oh, yes, we love Feature X. Use it all the time. And you look at the analytics and say, well, you've never used Feature X at all, not even a single time. And it turns out that users had been going through other features to basically find a workaround for Feature X that was right there to use, but they didn't know it was there. So they were basically manufacturing this feature by doing other things around it to try and get to this result. And you know, you can't always tell, basically. So giving your device to someone who does not use it, someone who does not use your app at all, they'll say, well, what does this button do? And it might catch fire. It might not do what they think it's going to do. It's worth finding out. It's called hallway user testing. People who just grab them and were walking in the hallway and say, hey, try us out and see what you think. And it's powerful stuff indeed.
Oh, yeah, the users, they take side quests to do everything. It is wild the way users sometimes use things like in the ways you don't expect. You're just like, this is not how I wanted this to work. It's like this game I remember. I don't know if it's still available. I think it is. It's called like Goat Simulator, where yes, they will literally just like, they don't fix the bugs sometimes in their app and they just literally make them into features. And then that's just something you can do in the game.
It's true. Goat Simulator is a great game. My daughter loves that game. And she finished Goat Simulator 3 recently. She's a big fan of that one.
I didn't know that there was an end to that game.
Oh, so yeah. So number three, there's a brilliant end to the game. I mean, because the first one, there were lots of bugs and it was just silly bugs. In three, the bugs are intentional. They get weirder and weirder as you go through the game. And the ending's fantastic. It's really, really clever.
Boz Brook mentions, build the onion layers, screen reader support, voice control, keyboard, lean into the native capabilities, including dark mode and dynamic type, help others on the team understand better and set them up for success too.
And for folks who don't know, Boz worked on the accessibility team at Apple. He knows his stuff very, very much. And so the tips here are just, you know, pure nuggets of gold. He's right, of course. When you've done something well, you've nailed something really well, great. Pass on that knowledge to other folks. Tell them how to do it as well. So the team builds up and builds up better and better knowledge. And he actually picks out one thing particularly here, which is voice control, which I ignored for a long time. And actually, I got to meet some of the team from this division accessibility at Apple Park last year. And they were like, hey, Paul, could you mention voice control in one of your tutorials? I'm like, voice control? How does that work? Oh! So I did an article about this, you know, me learning and me correcting my ways. It's now in the new 100A50Y for iOS 17. There's a chapter in there on voice control now, specifically to correct this long-standing error I have.
Yeah, and Boss also recently talked at iOS Dev Happy Hour, and we've started recording like the official talks that we have when people come in and like chat really quick. So I will drop the link for that for our iOS Dev Happy Hour YouTube channel, because he also mentions another, I can't think of it right now, another macOS tool that helps with accessibility as well too. Next up, Michael Temper mentions set accessibility labels / hints. So make different shapes for symbols and not only rely on colors, and reduce animations if needed. And then Chris Wu mentions, I make sure that using German using the largest text size on iPhone SE works well. I figure accommodate everything for large text is all downhill after that one looks nice. He also adjusts the UI elements to accommodate large text. So both of them mentioned multiple different things. So first, accessibility, labels and hints, and then also again using symbols, because if you only use color to differentiate something, like people use green for good, red for bad, well, if it's only like a green circle or a red circle, like that means nothing to somebody who is red, green, colorblind. So being able to use different shapes and symbols, and we have SF symbols to use everything, is great. And I love how Chris mentions to use German for the largest text size on an iPhone SE. Like, I love how specific that is. Is there like a reason for German?
Yeah, so German is one of the longer languages out there. It's what we call a synthesis language, where they produce words by synthesizing existing words. They basically strap them together. They get very, very long words sometimes. And so it can easily have a complicated UI. You know how you get the designer saying, I've got this great UI, it's really nice, in Sketch. And it's like, okay, cool. Now how does it look with two lines of text? Like, two lines of text? And it hasn't kind of planned out for that a little bit. Making it use German or similar is helpful because it forces you to use long languages. I would say, love Chris very much, there is actually an option in Xcode when you're in the app language options for your scheme, you can choose double length pseudo language and it automatically doubles up every word for you. So it'll be like, hello, hello, world, world. We print it to the screen, whatever it is, depending on what layout you have. And that way everything becomes twice as long and that will easily beat German. There's also right to left, accented and more in there. So you can really push your UI very, very hard.
Ooh, I didn't know about that. That sounds useful.
There you go. There you go. And another thing, this is while we're on the topics of me stirring around these nuggets of value, red and green is so interesting because red and green colorblind is particularly difficult for people to have. Many men suffer from that, and they just cannot tell the difference between red and green. And the other side of that is that it inverts in some countries. So in China, red is considered a good thing, and green is considered a bad thing. So Apple's Stocks app flip the colors around. So red is when it's going up and green when it's going down. And that's worth taking into account as well. These little cultural variations really matter.
Just forget all the men.
possible, yeah.
We also have Clemens Strasser, who mentions add additional fonts like Open Dyslexic one for people with dyslexia, switch the layout from an H stack to a V stack when using large type, and make sure the contrast levels are also fine.
Yeah, so that what about switching stacks used to be tricky because you'd have like a custom stack, for example, that read the environment of, say, dynamic type size or the horizontal size class, whatever. And that worked well for doing a switch from H stack to V stack. But the problem is it wouldn't keep state as those values changed. So if you want to see two views being switched from V stack to H stack and throw away the at state values inside those views. However, if you're able to, not everyone can, but if you're able to, you can use view that fits, which is a not commonly used 50UI view. And with view that fits, you can say, do view that fits, do a H-stack here, then the same thing as a V-stack, and basically provide two variations of your layout, or three or four or five variations of your layout. And SwiftUI will try them all in order and pick the first one that fits correctly. And so for some things, that works really, really well for switching between portrait and landscape or large type to small type, whatever. It can work really effectively as a way of making your UI flip between layouts quickly without you having to get into the weeds of exactly what font size you're using and similar.
Yeah, and that's super nice with View That Fits that you just put them all in order of the way that you want them displayed, and SwiftUI just figures it out for you. And then also with Open Dyslexic, is that a default Apple font or is that a different one that you would have to download?
So Open Dyslexic is a free font everyone download and use, and it changed the letter shapes so they're kind of skinny on top and chunky on the bottom, as if like gravity sucked a Helvetica font down a little bit. So it creates a feeling of permanence for letters, because some folks with dyslexia say they feel letters floating around a little bit, they aren't staying still on the page, they find hard to focus on them, and having the extra weight on the letter at the bottom apparently helps many people read more effectively when they have dyslexia.
Oh, that's cool. We'll also link that in the show notes for downloading and using that font.
Mm.
Bruno says currently he started working at a large bank whose accessibility efforts are heartening. Accessibility is a part of the ticket and design before they even work on it, and mandatory before a ticket is done. So there's a special accessibility guild to help other teams in their efforts and create our own guidelines from within the company. And there's regular audits that happen to see if the apps and websites comply. That's super nice, being able to actually design the ticket from the top, thinking about how accessible it's going to be, especially for like a banking app where we all have to manage money in some way. So being able to then have a banking app that actually takes all of that into account for literally every user is great.
Right. And it's a shame, but it's true. What you said is exactly why it happens here. We all have to manage money somehow. And that's why they're doing it. You know, many industries, like, for example, in the UK, our public service broadcaster, the BBC, they put a lot of work into accessibility because people want to watch TV, they want to listen to radio, and they have to serve the nation. And the same is true of, you know, banking apps. They have to support everyone, either by law now or by law soon. They have to support everyone. And I wish more folks just did it without being required, like that obviously are already doing, because it's just so important. Making your app work for everyone makes a huge difference to folks. And there's a brilliant video from, I think, WWDC 2017, maybe a while ago now, which was called Convenience for You is Independence for Me. And that's the key. You know, allowing someone to live their life independently should be the standard. We're not here to, you know, make it a nice thing to have or a little feature we'll put in if we have time for it. It should be baked in from day one to ensure everyone can use our apps fully.
Oh, I love that. That reminds me, too, of when I was at the Apple Women's Day event. I think it was Linda Dong who had mentioned that having accessibility and making your app accessible only opens your app to more people. So what is the business case for not wanting to do that?
And in fact, she gave a brilliant talk, I think WW 22, 21, maybe I want to say, where it was about accessibility in the widest possible sense. I mean, every possible thing being considered, things like, they mentioned the red-green thing in there, I think, for example. They mentioned, you know, getting an inclusive team of people together, thinking about cultural variations and all sorts of things. It was really, really broad, wide-reaching discussion, and it's one of the best, too.
Adrian Eves also mentions, who's one of the other organizers on iOS Dev Happy Hour, he mentions, familiarize yourself with VoiceOver and not on your own app. Practice it, learn it, and test drive it on apps you enjoy, or better yet, apps you think are excellently designed.
So Adrian, like Buzz, is actually one of the ex-Apple folks who worked on accessibility at Apple. And Adrian gets his stuff at the deepest possible level. And actually, by the way, he's looking for a job right now. So if you're thinking, hey, I need my someone to go through my app and give it a really thorough voiceover or switch control or voice control checkover, Adrian's your guy, because he'll come in and say, okay, let's run it through together, and he'll walk you through what the problems are, how to be fixed. He'll teach your team, mentor them. He's a really great developer, and he really gets this stuff deeply. And he's nailed it here. You know, just get familiar with this stuff. Look at an app you admire, any app, what happens to be, Duolingo or Calm, whatever it is, and use their app and say, yeah, I see what they're doing now. That's very clever. And take their ideas.
Yeah, and he even goes on to say, too, in this post, voiceover is also just one aspect of accessibility. There are 8 billion people on the planet, and no two folks are the same. So you'll have to consider things like dynamic type, coloration, imagery, and even looking at leading and trailing presentation in various countries, just to name a few of the different features. So then do your best to be inclusive. And if someone speaks up and suggests they don't feel included, graciously accept that as feedback and do your research to make it happen in your app. And it can happen. So no one is perfect, but we can do our part to be our best in our apps when developing them. Yeah, so like Adrian just said, he mentioned, oh my gosh, so many things. But I think the most important thing out of this too is especially that no two people are alike, and there's so many different people, and so many different people have different needs that just changing one small thing in your app can make all the world of difference. I know we were having a user on iOS Dev Happy Hour this past meeting, and Zoom's voiceover was screwing up. So it was harder for him to then get into the different breakout rooms. So we had to then just move him into a room. But one small thing in your app not working can just make all the difference for somebody else having to use and experience your application.
And by the way, this is just part of Adrian's response. He wrote a lot more on Twitter and replied to my request for open ballot responses. Because that's his level he's at. He thinks about a huge range of things at the same time. So check him out. I think he's Swift Eves on Twitter. Is that right?
I believe so.
Yeah. Go and check out Adrian. If you're looking at upping your accessibility game, Adrian's your guy.
And lastly, Michael Hewlett mentions probably the most important advice with using accessibility and implementing it into your app, which is have disabled people test it.
And that brings us to the end of the episode. Thank you so much for listening, folks. Next time at Open Ballot's going to be with WWDC just 2 months away. How are you preparing your app for the inevitable next big iOS release that's coming? Please tell your friends to subscribe. Of course, leave a review below. Until next time, folks, take care.
See ya. Time is a construct.